Welcome to the Sockdolager Wellness Podcast. This is a place where we discuss health and how to be a healthier human, whether that's physically, mentally, spiritually, or more. So if you want to be a healthier individual, buckle up and hang on, you're in for a ride. Okay, you guys, welcome back to another episode of the Sockdolager Wellness Podcast. Today, I'm lucky enough to take some audio from a podcast where I was a guest host on the Better You Movement podcast with Brady Kurtz. So without further ado, sit down, buckle up, hang on, and enjoy this podcast.
Alrighty, guys, welcome back to another episode of the Better You Movement. I am here with Dr. Eric Christensen, owner and lead physical therapist at Chandler Physical Therapy in Phoenix, Arizona. Eric, how are you doing?
I'm super good, man. Thank you so much for letting me join you today.
Hey, absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad we're able to do this. And I know I've kind of hinted to my listeners about what this is we're going to be talking about today, but we'll get to that in a little bit. But yeah, can you kind of just first by start by telling us a little bit about your background and kind of what led you to the physical therapy profession?
Yeah, definitely. So I grew up in Colorado. So a lot of outdoor stuff, was very active as a kid. And growing up, I ended up falling into wrestling in high school and tore my ACL in one of the matches. So that was kind of my first introduction. I ended up having that repaired and then going through the physical therapy process. And so that was the intro to my world of physical therapy. I'm like, wow, this is really cool. At the same time, we're having a bunch of like job fairs at high school. Okay, where do you want to kind of go when you're going towards college? And I knew kind of I wanted to lean towards medical, but I wasn't sure what. I'm pretty sure I didn't want to just be sitting in a visit for 5 minutes and give some pills away. So when I went through the PT process, you know, there's a lot of hands-on, there's a lot of collaboration, and you just build this bond that I really kind of gravitated towards. So I went into college, Colorado State University, thinking that, yeah, this is where I want to go, got into the health and exercise science program. Was able to work at the on-campus clinic there and was like, yeah, this is really solidifying kind of my drive there. Mm-hmm. And then went to Regis University in Denver for my PT school. And then after that, that's where I met my now wife. She's also a physical therapist. We came down to Arizona and then ultimately a couple of years later, opened up our own shop, Chandler Physical Therapy. And here we are today.
Yeah. Awesome. What was it like, you know, as far as when you were in that, was it the campus clinic? Was it a clinic through your university?
Yeah, it was the on-site Colorado State. It was through their medical center, but they had physical therapy in the basement. If you can imagine that, it's kind of a running joke.
Yeah. What kind of setting was that in? Like, what was that kind of your first exposure to physical therapy? And did you kind of have to do your own research in order to kind of figure out what it looked like, you know, from a broader scope?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because you had clinicians that kind of did everything. You had one that was like strictly treated triathletes. And then another one, Steve, he was actually going through his transitional DPT at Regis at the time. So he had a little different perspective and he was very much in that mentorship. He was getting mentored. So then he was mentoring and kind of sharing, okay, this is what you can expect. And then, you know, he was detailing, okay, if you want to go to PT school, this is what you can expect. It's not going to be, you know, the glamorous, you're going to be living cheap, you know, but if you get out with less loans, that's the big goal. So I had a lot of mentorship that way. But it was at your general outpatient clinic, a lot of orthopedic stuff, especially with college kids that, you know, may have been not so smart the weekend before, but you'd have, we had a women's health lady there too. So you saw a little bit of that, at least some, maybe on the outset and some of the exercise in the gym. Yeah. And looking back now, you know, some of the stuff was a little outdated. They still had their little, I can't even remember what it's called now. You put your feet in the bath in a whirlpool, the whirlpool therapy. Okay. and I got to clean that a lot and the stuff like that, you know, which now, at least in my world, we don't use that as much. And I don't think you see it as much either. But you know, it's kind of that interesting transition, but they were very hands-on. And I think that was what drew me in even more is that, you know, Steve would come in and he'd bring somebody in and they'd have this history and he knew what they did last weekend. And yeah, I mean, you're building this collaboration of almost friends, you know, but on a more professional side, it was really, really neat to see.
Yeah. Yeah. And one more thing, I just kind of wanted to ask you a little bit, you know, you mentioned that you were a wrestler in high school and that's how you tore your ACL, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm sure that was a pretty, pretty interesting experience or impactful experience, obviously, to be in physical therapy. What was your relationship like with the physical therapist you work with? Was that a big part of, you know, that kind of like foundational, like, oh, I get to really work with people, you know, in this saying, I know my physical therapist really well. Was that a good experience for you when you were a younger guy?
Yeah, it was really good. And his name was Eric too, ironically. You know, it was neat to see the benchmarks. He was very good about, okay, this is when we progress to this. This is when we progress to this. And that, you know, as a 17, almost 18 year old at the time, like, you know, maybe you're not as invested. You think you're kind of invincible. You're going to heal. Mm-hmm. But now looking back, I feel like I'm better off because of it for sure. And he was say, okay, we get to this and then we can, you know, jog, or we're going to do this and you can kick the brace off and we're going to do this. And I was very into, obviously, as a physical, and then being an 18, I was really into lifting weights and trying to be the best version of myself, more aesthetically, maybe, for the ladies at the time. But, you know, it was that part too, like, okay, yeah, you have permission to go squat, you have permission to go bench press, deadlift, all that sort of stuff. And they had that on facility or in the facility, which, and he could kind of monitor. And while you were a patient there, you could use the facility as a gym. Unlimited, and he would pop in even if you weren't on a visit. And I thought that was really cool. And he'd check in and be like, hey, don't do that, do this type stuff. So it was a good building of a relationship. And, you know, he made me take ownership of it, but at the same time, he was kind of mentoring it all the way through. And I like that.
Yeah. And the reason I asked that, you know, I personally as well, like I dislocated my shoulder my sophomore year of high school, playing football. And did it a few more times throughout the season, had a torn labrum, got that repaired, and went through, you know, the labrum protocol in physical therapy. And I was the 16-year-old kid that was like, all right, just get me back. Like, I just want to get back to playing football. And they're like, all right, and here's what you need to do. Like, you need to put in the work here. And I was just like, oh, come on. You know, I was just and looking back on it, I'm like, oh my gosh, I would have hated to probably work with me. But what was, you know, the second time when I had the bigger shoulder surgery, the more complications because I was dumb the first time, was way more impactful for me because I had the same physical therapist and it was nothing that he did wrong. It was almost 100% on me that I didn't really take those steps that, you know, take ownership of it for myself. And he was able to have kind of some of those harder conversations with me. He's like, listen, man, if you want to be back here, if you want to be doing what you want to do, and if you can take a second and look beyond this moment and look 20, 30, 40 years down the line, if you want to have a shoulder here that you're able to do stuff with and want to live your life, like, I'm your guy. Like, I'm going to be right here with you, but I need you to take ownership of this as well. Do the stuff that I'm asking you to do here at home. And I was like, man, from that point on, like, all of a sudden he was very much of like a, not like a big brother, but just someone that you knew he was there for you. And that was a huge point in my life where I was like, oh my gosh. Okay. Like, physical therapy is different. Like, it's just, right. It's different. The relationship that you get to form with your patient and now being in physical therapy school. And the question I'm always asking, I feel like, to all my professors and my classmates, I'm like, well, yeah, but what if, you know, this is a perfect scenario, right? Like, what does this actually look like? And they're like, you're going to find out, you know, because you're going to have patients that aren't compliant, all that kind of stuff. So I always like to just kind of ask that question because, you know, everybody has a different experience with their, maybe when they went to physical therapy, but that was always really impactful for me. So I think that's cool. You were able to.
It's a great profession to be in because you're literally changing lives.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If people are willing to team up with you, like, you can make some really profound changes. And that's why I really like PT, is that we're in a position now where, you know, prevention is more on the forefront, and like, we're in a great place to really get people healthier, more active, and, you know, really build those bonds on a community level, on a national level, and a world level, really. But yeah. that's what keeps me excited in the profession for sure.
Yeah. So when you, you're obviously now in Phoenix, you own and run your own practice with your wife.
Correct.
Yeah. So what kind of people, you know, when you guys opened that, what was your vision for, you know, the kind of patients that you wanted to, or do, you know, work with and see on a daily basis?
Yes. So we both came from clinics that were extremely busy. Like, they were very business minded, and, you know, obviously we own a business, so you have to be business minded, but there's a way to do business to maximize profits. And there's a way to do business to maximize, effect on your patients. And we wanted to be more on that effect of the patients. Like, we're not looking to be the richest people in the world, but I think we're rich as far as ability to give back to the community. And so that was our goal. You know, we wanted to emphasize going to Regis, they emphasized a hands-on approach. That's something we both really gelled with. So we wanted to make sure we incorporated an appropriate amount of time with our patients to make sure we were able to do whatever we needed to do on the table, whether that's exercise, whether that's a hands-on manipulation, mobilization, whatever we need to do, or education even, because sometimes people just need time to talk and or be heard. So we wanted to incorporate that and then have a good background where we could provide skilled exercise interventions to progress people. And one of the big things for us is the patient experience, as far as, you know, I've been to PT clinics that feel like a morgue and it is awful, terrible. So we didn't want to be that. We wanted to have a good atmosphere. We wanted it to feel welcoming, you know, kind of the home away from home, your third home. You got work, home, and then PT. You know, if you have to come, we wanted to be able to do that. Where, you know, one of the things we stress is when you walk in the door, people are being greeted. And it may not be by their therapist, like, hey, Steve, you know, and you know, Lindsay, who's never put her hands on you or even treated you, knows who you are. And I think that's really brings it up to the forefront where they feel like they're comfortable walking in no matter what.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the vision we had walking in and what we built up. And okay, now that we're established, we've been in business for almost 10 years now, you know, we're getting a lot of repeat customers, you know, from different things and or their families, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And you really start to see, okay, so-and-so referred this person who then referred three other people, and you get this huge kind of almost family tree of effect. And that's where you start to see over the long term, the effect you can have. And that's kind of the vision we had, and it's really coming to life. It's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you're talking about local community as well, I mean, you know, beyond all of the other things, you know, you obviously have to do to promote your business. I mean, word of mouth, I mean, just to have that network of people. That's always a question I've asked people too, is the difference between working in a much more corporate, setting where being a PT, you are, you know, basically having your patients given to you through a funnel, through basically, you know, just referrals from physicians, whatever avenue, you know, through the healthcare system, where the difference lies between having your patients being handed to you, you treat them, they go on their way, and then you will automatically have the next one coming in, as opposed to having more of a small business mindset where you're like, we have to create an experience, you know, for our patients that they like you said, have this kind of home away from home where like the people I care about most in my life, like, I don't want you going to this place. I want you to go to Eric. I want you guys to go to Chandler. Like, you guys have to go here. That I think that's awesome, because not only you said you get repeat clients, you know, you have the same people coming back to you for issues. And obviously we talked about how prevention is more on the forefront. So you're getting more of those type of referrals as well. I think that's, that is such a strong and like sustainable, you know, way to view running a practice. I think that's awesome. But, yeah, I wanted to kind of transition here, because one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on, and to be able to share your insights here, is that you wrote a book. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Why you wrote the book? What it's called? What it's about? Just tell us a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's called Breathe Better, and ultimately, I big into ways to access people's wellness in ways that maybe they're not used to. People been through lots of PT. They know they need to do the exercises, but maybe their breathing's off. And a lot of people's breathing, especially in today's society with how fast it's moving, how much we're sitting comparatively to what we were doing 100 years ago, is feeding into a protective response, with breathing that isn't necessarily healthy. Mm-hmm. And so I was seeing a lot of this and also seeing at the same time, how well, if we can correct this, how well things on the physical side can change, but then also the emotional, you know, anxiety, all that sort of stuff can change as well. And when that starts to come in about, then people's like view on the world, their wellness, suddenly their whole behavior changes, their whole energy kind of changes. And so that's why I kind of wanted to write on it, because it's a great tool to open people's eyes. Mm-hmm. And then it's a good way, you know, from a business standpoint, also to introduce yourself, be like, hey, you know, this is my book, read it and check it out. If you think it's something you want to dive into, let me know.
Yeah.
But really big picture kind of stuff is, when we're looking at today's society, we tend to be on a spectrum of stress, in the overstressed versus understressed. And that tends to generate what we call a protective apical breathing posture. And we tend to breathe more from our upper chest, versus our diaphragm. And that works really, really well. Say you're sprinting and you need to get away, we need to get more air in, you're going to adopt that chest breathing pattern. That's perfect for that situation. But if we're at rest and we're not really technically threatened, we shouldn't be using that as our primary driver for air, because that triggers what we call a sympathetic response, which is a, you know, the nervous system. We have sympathetic versus parasympathetic, your fight or flight versus your rest and relax. If you're constantly in fight or flight, like prepared for action, as if something's going to attack you, your body's going to have certain issues with that. You're going to have muscle tension that doesn't release. You're going to have excess cortisol levels. You're going to have heightened stimulation that then is hard to come down from, or maybe you're overreactive to, you know, like when you put your hands on a patient and suddenly they're jumping off the table, man, they're wound up tight. And it's right. Not that they overtly are stressed. It's probably just the whole lifestyle is coming down on them. And so that's kind of why I wrote it. And then in the book, it talks about, you know, kind of the genesis, what are the big muscle players for inhalation? What are the big muscle players for exhalation? And then we dive into the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, and then kind of some corrective stuff, some techniques that I love to use that I use in the clinic all the time. And then I jump into just a sample routine that you can adopt day to day, which is not hard and fast. It's just something I kind of like.
Well, you know, as I was reading it, one of the biggest things that during my master's, when I was at K-State, I got my master's in kinesiology, and my master's, my thesis was largely in biomechanics. And, and that's not really the point, but my advisor, her, one of the things she harped on so much, and she thought the biggest problem with, I think, the research community was that still we're not there yet on scientific communication, and we're doing all this, you know, I think world changing research out there that's just not being communicated to the public, or it's not being transitioned into something that's actually usable. And, right. And so, you know, that was always just something that she harped on so much, in the way that we write, the way that we present when we go to conferences, that kind of stuff. But so that's always something I'm thinking about whenever I'm reading something that's obviously much higher level, higher level information, not easily digestible. When you can put that into terms that people, not just like layman's terms, like, oh, thanks for dumbing it down for me, but you're like, no, you give me the part that I need, like you give me the information that I need to actually, you know, apply that for myself. And that's something I definitely came through. How important was that for you when you were writing it, to be able to try to speak to people? You know, you could go off, I mean, on every single one of those muscles, like you talked about, the major players in diaphragmatic breathing versus apical breathing. But you conversated, you talked to your audience. How important was that for you?
It was important on a couple different levels, honestly, because, you know, in my other PTs will say, I dictate exactly how I talk. I dictate into it, but I mean, it's pretty much me coming through. So it's very conversational in general. And I wanted that because, again, I feel that one of my big things when I do have students in the clinic is that you have to be able to educate the patient well, because if they don't understand why they're doing it or what the purpose is, we're missing the point entirely. They're not going to be invested in it. And so a lot of my career has been cultivated in making very complex things seem ridiculously easy. And I'm pretty sure you're familiar with Gray Cook. And he's exceptional at this, right? Like that's how it should be said, you know, and that was kind of the vibe I was going for. I want to make something that's very complex, seem very simple to understand, because all the ins and outs are not necessary to make this an effective technique. So let's take what is going to be important. Let's reference it to something that people understand. And then let's deliver it in a way that's it's fun and keeps you captured. And that was the kind of the big goal of the book.
What has the response been like as far as, I don't know if I asked this already, when did you write this? When did it finally come out?
First one came out in 2017 now. I just revised, you know, finally went back and realized how many grammatical errors were in it and tried to filter it out. I released that one last year, I guess, probably right around this time last year was version 2 of that.
Gotcha. Like, what has like the response been to it? So have people been able to see, like, you know, just on their own, you know, someone that has really no connection to you, have people been able to kind of implement this on their own, or more times you see it people who work with you that are then able to kind of use this as supplemental material that they take this home and then they kind of apply this because of what you're able to work with them on the clinic? You know, do you kind of see both sides of that?
I do see both sides. I have some people who I've never met in my life message me, say, hey, I got, you know, this really helped me, thank you. And maybe they have some clarification questions. I also have this patient, you know, whose husband's having horrible headaches and, you know, has this. And I'm like, well, you know, breathing. And I'm like, this could help with this. And she's like, oh, and I'm like, well, I wrote a book on it. Do you want to check it out? And they take it home either for them or for their spouse or something, somebody they know as well. Mm-hmm. One of the stranger things or cooler things I should say is this guy from Iceland emails me. He's like, I'd love to get a copy of your book. And, you know, we do that. And he and I have been communicating back and forth, you know, it's like, yeah. How far reaching can you get from, right. You know, and I'm not out there pushing it, you know, in ads on the internet or anything, but somehow through the magic of the internet, he found me and was able to get a copy of the book. And, you know, now you're changing lives thousands of miles away. It's really cool.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Yeah. So, and I guess now, you know, clinically speaking, like when you're actually, treating your patients, you know, how much of, you know, breathing education and postural education, a lot of, you know, the kind of things that you talk about in the book, is that something that you kind of that you pick and choose as far as like, you know, this applies to this patient, or do you feel like this is something I can really kind of integrate with just about all my patients to some extent, you know, kind of, you know what I mean? Like if this patient has no complaints of breathing or any complaints of any of this kind of stuff, but obviously may, you know, when you interview them or when you're hearing about their history, they're, you know, highly stressed person. Do you kind of use that, like pick and choose of what you use here as far as what you think is going to work for that specific patient? Or
yeah, absolutely. I mean, you 9 out of 10 times you're going to find somebody who could probably benefit from breathing correction. Mm-hmm. Does it apply to their specific dysfunction is a different story, right? I mean, I would argue yes, but is it going to be the best bang for their buck to get their buy-in and get them to stay with you for the course of treatment? Maybe, maybe not. Yeah. So that's going to be kind of that subjective choice you have to make when you interview the patient, right? But a lot of times what I'm looking for, not only breathing patterns, but okay, when you interview somebody for their subjective for the first time, you're looking at, okay, what is their energy like? You can tell when people are ramped up really high, you know, and that sort of stuff. That's what I'm looking at, because really for the breathing techniques that I'm looking at, it's a wind down technique. It's not like the Wim Hof style where you're ramping up necessarily, which has its own house. But for most of my people, they're already ramped up. We don't need to facilitate that. We need to bring them down a notch or two. And so that's kind of what I'm looking for, those presentations. Okay. Are we, you know, overly sympathetic? Can I even be effective with my hands, or do we need to do something to dull that sensation down to make it more effective? That's where I find, especially in the early sessions, breathing jumps in really well for me.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, which is a really fun thing for patients to see, is that if you're not breathing through your diaphragm correctly, when we look at breathing, it's the thing that's going to kill us quickly if we stop. Like it's the fastest way to kill us, right? And so the body knows that. And so we are going to be successful in getting air in at any cost. And so when you look at the driver, the importance that has for the body, you're looking for compensatory patterns. And so if the diaphragm's not participating, what is? Because obviously this patient is still surviving. Is it, you know, our scalenes and our levator scap and all that sort of stuff? Yeah, probably. And then does that carry over into, okay, why is that shoulder impinged? Is it because they're not moving well? Yeah, then let's look at breathing, because that's going to be a novel way rather than just stretching these muscles.
Right.
That. And then suddenly, you know, let's take your left hip. Its internal rotation is limited 20 degrees because your hip flexor and your rectus is trying to pull a vacuum by using lumbar lordosis instead of your diaphragm descending. If I can get you kicking through your diaphragm and reduce that tension, and suddenly your hip strength and hip range of motion improves without me ever touching your hip,
right?
Like that gets some really cool buy-in. So my approaches tend to be show and then teach. Mm-hmm. And I talk to my students all the time, like leave breadcrumbs, be like, see why this is here. That's going to be important. Let's get back to it. Mm-hmm. So then you're kind of cueing the patient to understand what's important, because you're going to throw a ton of information, especially in that initial session. So, okay, let's look at that. We go back to it. Remember when we didn't have this and now we didn't, I never touched your hip. That's because X, Y, and Z. And that's where I jump into maybe some breathing education. But if you just be talking, be like, well, you're breathing wrong. People have heard it before and it's shut down city. But if I can show you, hey, maybe, you know, we need to breathe out more than we breathe in, suddenly they're a little more attentive after I've shown them how it can change.
Right. Yeah. And I like what you said there. Cause I mean, at the end of the day, if you're only treating the orthopedic issue, you're only treating the impingement in the shoulder, the, you know, whatever it may be. And yet, you know, you have all this other stuff going on, you know, that's the quickest way to have something revert or have something, or not, you know, you're not fixing 100% of the problem. There's still a break in the armor there that's going to eventually lead back to that, that problem. So I really like that. And I was on the way actually back here, actually from lab about an hour ago. And I remembered that this entire story that I was like, this is so relevant to the conversation we're having today. But about probably 12 or 13 years ago, when I was, you know, 11, I think it was 10 or 11 years old, I don't know. For like 9 months, it was like a bronchial infection, upper respiratory tract infection, something, but basically it was there for like 9 months. It was like, we treated it a million different ways. I essentially had bronchitis for like a year. And I was a super active kid playing a bunch of other sports, but my lungs and my throat, everything was so raw. Like I was in so much pain from coughing. Every time I cough, I would just be in just terrible pain. And so essentially I basically on my own, and I was just a little kid, I just learned to breathe differently so that I didn't have to really expand my diaphragm. I didn't have to expand my lungs because just that breathing pattern was painful. Right. And essentially what happened, I mean, I was just exactly what you were talking about, just only breathing with in every single time. So my parents actually ended up taking me to an SLP or a speech pathologist, speech language pathologist, who then, you know, to me, it was like, we're going to play some games. Like we're going to do some activities. And basically she just taught me how to breathe again. Like she taught me how to, and she called these relaxation exercises that, you know, if I wanted to try to go to sleep at night and try to, you know, fall asleep better, I should do these exercises. And so I was all for it. I thought it was cool that I was getting medical attention, all this kind of stuff. But basically she did all these patterns that a lot of them are what you talk about in your book, and what I want you to share with us here in a sec. But it was just crazy for me because I was diagnosed with sports induced asthma, and it kind of somewhat fit the profile, but it wasn't that at all. Right. And I learned how to breathe again. And obviously the infection bronchial stuff went away, which obviously helped. But sure. it was amazing to me because I couldn't breathe for essentially like a year and a half after that, because I had no stamina when I was playing sports and soccer. I learned how to breathe again. And I think the long-term ramifications of it was that I actually was taught how to properly breathe as an 11-year-old, whereas right. most of us never get that what you talked about, that education component, how important that is. And I think a lot of people, you know, 20, 30, 40 years later are now seeing the results or like the ramifications of these kind of heightened, you know, sympathetic breathing patterns that, you know, that now have those effects on their body. So I looked at that, I was like, wow, that is kind of crazy that I've always been so focused on my breathing because of something that happened to me when I was 11. But at the same time, like that was just someone working with me, teaching me how to, you know, relax, quote unquote, relax as a kid that really ended up making a huge difference for me. And I think has prevented or at least definitely suppressed a lot of other problems that could have happened because I know how to breathe. And I think I do in general, I am able to kind of suppress that over excitatory response that I would normally be going through, you know, a lot of the day. So I thought that was a really cool story. I don't know that.
Absolutely. No, it's perfect because like, I think if you can learn that at a young age and manage it, like we talk, I have three kids, the oldest being 8. And you know, they'll get worked up about something. The first thing we do is, okay, let's take a breath. Cause if you're wound up, it's hard to make rational decisions. Number one, but, mm-hmm. you know, if you can learn that at a young age, it's huge because we have an entire generation who was taught that, you know, grin and bear it, grit through it, rub some dirt on it. And you know, no pain, no gain, which isn't always the case. There are instances where maybe, yeah, you got to push through some pain, but a lot of times if you're protecting yourself from something emotionally, physically, or whatever, that's going to come out in the wash sometimes. And you might have history, like years of that, you know, and if you can learn that from a young age, we're going to see decreased, you know, cortisol, anything that cortisol can affect, your diabetes, your insulin resistance, all that sort of stuff. If we can see that come down, imagine the effect of, you know, public health in general and the burden on healthcare. And that's huge. And it's a simple tool, right? Not a whole lot necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to ask you your thought on one other thing that I just, you know, from reading your book and then also just what I'm seeing in kind of the physical therapy space right now, is there's like such a push, I think this kind of, or it's just a hot topic is like posture. Posture, yeah. I think, is a pretty hot topic right now. And, And, you know, the way you reference it when you talk about it in your book, in many ways is not necessarily saying like, all right, you have to look like a robot all the time, you know, but it is talking about here's what happens when, you know, we do have kind of some of these chronic changes in the way that we, you know, because of stress, because of the way that we sit for long periods of time. Like, we'll just talk about it. This is the effect that it has on your breathing when you have, you know, excessive kyphotic, internally rotated, punched over. You mentioned kind of this fetal position almost that ends up looking like, you know, what we do all day when we're hunched over at our desk. And so, you know, I think you talk it to it from a really appropriate standpoint, but then there's also kind of just this big movement. I feel like right now people saying, and from my point of view, I think a lot of this has transferred over from how much emphasis people are putting on performance, and that's kind of bled from the strictly athletic population into general population. So more people than ever are trying to move well and efficiently, and people are, you know, are doing things like CrossFit, other things that like they're training for their own, you know, fitness. But people, the more fitness forward we're getting, more people are trying to improve movement. And so from a performance standpoint, like the way that we move, it absolutely matters. Like there's not a lot of compromise for the mechanics behind safe, efficient movement.
Right.
But then when that translates into the rest of our life, you know, it started to be this kind of thing. It's like, hey, if you look like this, then you're automatically going to have severe neck pain, and you're going to have low back pain, and you're going to do all these things if you don't do a perfect hinge as you reach over to, you know, get the laundry. And it's kind of just this, I want to know your thoughts on it, you know, because obviously we talk about posture as definitely having an effect on breathing, you know, but then as on the other side, we're also saying it's not always obviously for everybody a direct correlation to pain or discomfort. So I wanted to know kind of just from your perspective, or even how you treat your patients, when you see, you know, what you consider postural deviations, what does that say to you, and how much does context matter?
Yeah, I think, I mean, context is always going to be huge, right? I think with everything. But when I see somebody with, you know, your typical forward head posture, to me, posture is just your body's way of stabilizing appropriately for you. You're stabilizing that position because of maybe you're weak in your extensor chain. Who knows? I don't know that yet. Or maybe you're stiff through your mid back, and so you can't get into what we consider normal posture. But if you slouch for a while, that shouldn't be the end of the world. And if you stand up rigid for the all day, that's not the answer either. You know, there's a big saying going around, you know, your next posture is your best posture. And I completely, I'm on board with that. That you need to be moving. As humans, we are built to move. And I can't remember who said it, but they likened like a human statue. If you were to take anatomically correct human statue and that base of support, the first thing a wind would do would knock that statue over, because the base of support is not huge. Our feet relative to our body is not optimal. But what we do have is we have the ability to take a center of gravity and drop it very quickly, changing from potential energy to kinetic energy to create movement. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we really shine in the world right there. And so if you're constantly changing your posture, you're activating different muscles. I think that is more of an answer than anything. If I see somebody pulled over through here, either, yes, they're not changing their posture enough. So we need to have some education on that. If they're here for a little while on your phone, that's fine. Same people read the newspaper that way for years. It's not the be all end all, but if they're never leaving that, therein lies the problem. Right, but right. Again, like you were having a hard time getting air in or air in comfortably. You may have adopted that posture because that's where it was stable enough for you to breathe. For the same reason, when you're out of breath, you're going to hunch over. That's an easy way to get air in. So if we're correlating this back to breathing, you know, maybe they have a hard time getting good air in. And is that because the ribs aren't moving, or is that because the diaphragm isn't working, or some combination of that? That's kind of what kicks into my head in that capacity. Yes, there needs to be some education about it, but nobody likes to be chastised. Everybody knows they slouch.
Yeah.
But if you tell them, hey, maybe this is why you're here, they're going to be far more open to changing it than just be like, stand up straight.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't know how. Like it's hard saying.
Yeah. I love that. And honestly, that answer, I mean, that I think that really does highlight why it's so important. One, especially as a clinician, I mean, for students out there, I mean, that I would say this, what we're talking about right now, probably is not something that you're going to have a huge emphasis on placed on overall in your education, but, right. And yet is something that is, I think could be huge for so many people. Right. So I think that's really cool. I think those are conversations that matter, and it's important for good PTs to have a, have an understanding of this in the way that, you know, it, this is very integrally, you know, interwoven into, you know, every patient's condition because everybody breathes. Right. So, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because, I mean, in PT school, you're going to get these little snippets of these perfect case studies because you can be tested on it. Mm-hmm. PT school has to make sure you're safe and make sure you understand good concepts. And then you have to be tested on a national level compared to every other school. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean you see the big picture and how it's all woven together. Right. And that's why you go out on clinical rotations to take that in. And so that, you know, if you got a lot of students listening on this one, you know, take advantage of your clinical rotation for that, because understanding the nice, neat packages you're presented in the classroom rarely happen in the real world. And being able to, you know, kind of dance with that is what's really going to take you from a good clinician to a great clinician.
Right. Absolutely. So kind of with that being said, you know, whether you're talking to students about, you know, working with their patients, or if you're just talking to someone directly, you know, what are like, you know, one or two pieces of advice or things that you would start by, you know, start by having them do in order to try to maybe, you know, correct some of these breathing patterns? Like, how can I get somebody that's, you know, going from a very apical chest breathing kind of style to diaphragmatically breathe and be able to kind of just relax and unwind?
Yeah. So a couple things. First, the one I would say is breathe out before you breathe in. A lot of times when we're in that apical position, we are stuck with little snips of breath in. And so relatively on the spectrum of breathing out versus breathing in, we're more on the inhaling side versus the exhaling side. So if you're trying to fill a balloon that's already full, it's going to be really hard and it could be frustrating, and that could ramp up that nervous system even more. So I almost always have, you know, a little breath in and then try and get all your air out. Because when you get all the air out, it primes you to get more air in a better fashion. It's not going to be perfect, but it's going to start the process. And so I almost always say, you know, you got to breathe out to breathe in. We do a lot of what we call forced exhalation breathing through a straw or into balloons, something like that, because it does. It forces you to really focus on getting air out. And when you do get that air out, you get your core involved. It gives a better situation for the diaphragm to participate, and that kicks in. And then suddenly the inhale becomes much more effective.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I say is slow your breathing down. I would say universally, most of us are probably breathing at a more rapid rate than necessary. And I utilize a tool called box breathing or square breathing. You might've heard it as, where you inhale for 4 seconds, pause for 4 seconds, exhale for 4 seconds, pause for 4 seconds. And what that does, and you could use any amount of time, 4 seconds is not a hard and fast rule. But that does is force you to pace your own breathing, and it forces you to take pauses. And it takes you from, you know, an average of maybe 12 to 20 breaths a minute to like 3 or 4.
Yeah.
That does is it really regulates, if we want to get down to the nuts and bolts of oxygen versus carbon dioxide in your blood and the acidic pH of your blood and how that can affect like your nervous system, it's going to regulate that, then the biochemistry side of it. But then it's also just going to slow you down because your body's going to respond to your breathing rate and create vigilance in relative to that breathing rate.
Yeah. So I had two questions there. Like first, I like what you talked about when you talk about kind of some of this forced exhalation, because I feel like you're also getting a lot more, you know, proprioceptive feedback from your core when I don't think a lot of people probably realize like what really forced exhalation actually feels like, especially when you're just getting that last little bit of air, how much you actually are using, you begin to use those accessory muscles as well for,
it's hard to do if you're doing it right.
Yeah. And so I guess my other question then would be, you know, what are you telling your patients when they're going home? Am I setting an alarm on my phone every hour to do 2 minutes of this? Or, you know, is there something that, how do you get people to kind of buy into this long-term once they leave the clinic?
Yeah. I mean, that would depend on kind of where they're at nervous system wise, but I will say you got to at least do it once a day, if not more, and whenever you need to do it.
Yeah.
This is not something they're going to overdose on. Right.
Right.
You know, and I will liken that to their symptoms. Say, so when you start to feel like that tension back here, as you're starting to get a headache, that's your cue that you need to take time and do that. You know, you can tell them set an alarm every hour. People aren't going to stick with that. People will notice when they start to feel uncomfortable, right. And say that happens. if you want to be successful with this, let's do this. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be, you know, that, you know, as little as is necessary, but as much as you need to type deal, you know, but at least once a day, especially right before bed. A lot of people have a hard time sleeping. Sleep quality is not great. We could do a whole nother podcast on that. But if you can get that nervous system ramped down and kind of whole body to relax a little bit before bed, usually the outcome the next morning is going to be far more favorable. So that tends to be where I get people at. And that's when they have the time, you know, and mm-hmm. hopefully the focus to do so yep. as well.
Do you work at all? Do you work at all with movement while you breathe? Is that something where you work with people, whether or not it's like trying to breathe to like, to own positions, whether or not that's, I don't know, you know, like upper body breathing, neck, any type of neck mobility, anything, does that help? Do you see that being beneficial for your patients ever? Or is
yeah, that absolutely. Something that. And especially just not holding your breath while you're doing exercises, you know, there's that basic cue, right? But let's take like somebody who's squatting, has pain with squatting, and, you know, you're going to do an appropriate squat assessment. Let's say they're rounding with their lumbar spine early. Mm-hmm. I might incorporate breathing in a way like, okay, if we're looking at the general way we breathe, when we inhale, it facilitates extension of the spine and body. And when we exhale, it facilitates flexion. Yep. If we look at that squat that's rounding early at the depth, that's an error where we're overly flexed erroneously. So let's focus on our breathing so that as you get to depth, we are taking that inhale so we can promote extension at the depth of the squat.
Yeah.
And so in that way, we are forcing, and you, when you look at the diaphragm and the core, like that's a nice little cone of support. If we've got a big field in there, it's going to hold you a lot more stable anyway.
Right.
And that's kind of what you see the genesis of yoga. And if you look at when somebody's appropriately cueing, when you exhale versus inhale, exhalation tends to go with your extensive postures, flexion postures to hold extension and vice versa, you know? So you can look at, you know, how you're going to create stability with your breath to offset errors of that common movement. It's kind of how I take that. You can also use breathing. Like say, I want to stretch my scalenes. If I'm leaning, you know, and doing your typical scalene stretch, if I breathe with my belly in, that's going to take a stretch down and you're going to add to that stretch even more. Right. Same with your lat. If I'm stretching overhead and leaning into a lat and I inhale and I expand those ribs even more, you're getting that little extra, you know, yeah. on the top of that. So depending on where that person's at, that might be a great addition. They may not be ready for it too.
Yeah, that's awesome. So last question, you know, and again, like I said, because I think a lot of my listeners are in healthcare, in students.
Right.
What would be, do you have any advice for current students? I know we have students actually, what is it, May? So we have a new cohort of students that are about to begin that, you know, physical therapy school journey here in the next month. We also have a bunch of people who I think literally just this last week took the MPTE or are studying to do it here in a few months. So just as far as, you know, students starting their journey or people graduating, what do you have any advice that you would give them as far as just you know, getting through that or working towards trying to be the best clinician they can?
Yeah, I mean, I would say keep an open mind. Things aren't always as they seem and things are always changing. You know, what we were dead set on 20 years ago now is like a wash this, you know, nowadays. So keep an open mind, but I mean, in general, never stop learning. You know, whether that's, you know, you start your own business and you're doing a business side or whether you're doing more of the clinical side, don't stop pushing yourself. And I think that's, you know, especially right out of school, you're going to have the gung ho. I'm going to go do my, you know, OCS and I'm going to get my fellowship and do all that sort of stuff. And then the people like, I am so tired of learning. I'm going to take 3 years out. And you know, I think that's a trap you fall into because then it gets very comfortable and you'll complete your, you know, CEUs for what you need for your state requirements, but maybe not go above and beyond. And in especially early on, you're probably going to have more time than later in your career, you know, if you're following the typical path where you have kids and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Invest that time early as far as let's learn about things. If you have a patient that's kind of questionable, do your due diligence, like look it up, take the time now, take 10 minutes every day. Just do a quick research. And that could be Google or, you know, the MedBridge has awesome things that you can do 10 minutes at a time online and it's not super cumbersome. But don't stop learning because at the end of the day, you know, your patients and who you're going to benefit, there's a compound effect with that. You know, over the course of 10 years, that amount of knowledge and how you apply it is going to be, you know, amazing and you're going to help somebody out with it.
Yep. I completely agree with that. That's one of the best pieces of advice I've gotten too, is like, and what I fully plan to do is how important those first, few years out of school are, not only maximizing your clinical rotations, obviously, but just to like, to maximize those clinical skills, that clinical reasoning, just to really solidify those. That's something that like is at the forefront of my mind when I graduate, is like, I want to find the job that's going to make me the best physical therapist that I possibly can be, while also, like you said, continuing to look into, put in the work early, and just never stop learning. So I think that's awesome.
I would encourage you too. Like, it's not the job that makes the PT. And it's the PT that makes the PT. So you could be in a terrible situation and still be an amazing PT and learn more. Yeah. And I've had friends who went into this job expecting really good mentorship, and then time and a schedule gets in the way. And so, find that mentorship for yourself. And I might even encourage you, like, certainly make it happen in the clinic that you're going to land in if you can, but also, I mean, the internet's a beautiful place. You have Facebook groups, you have people doing mentorships all over. Find that mentor that's going to push you regardless of location too. Yeah. Because I know when I landed in my job, my schedule was full by like week four. Everybody else's schedule was full. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted it. People were so worried about getting documentation done and doing that. And they're like, oh yeah, we do mentorship and Mondays. And I know I've tried to offer that, and then life gets in the way. Like it's hard. Right. And then, by 6 months out of school, I was a clinic director by myself in a clinic with literally, I was the only therapist there. So it's like, who's going to mentor me now? So I would encourage you to find those avenues and those, you're in a good study habit right now, but find what interests you, learn about it and learn how to apply it.
Yeah.
Independent of where you're at.
That's awesome. All right. Well, hey, Eric, if people want to get in touch with you, want to reach you, where can they find you on social media?
Oh yeah. Clinic is at Chandler Physical Therapy, on Instagram. I am on Twitter, but not very often. The Facey as well. You can get me on Facebook at Facebook, search Chandler Physical Therapy. We're on there. Cool. And what I'll do is, I'll put a little link, maybe just our website is chandlerpt.net.
Yep.
And I'll put like /Brady, after that. And I'll put a little login form. And if you want, I'll email you a free, ebook of the book. If your listeners want to check that out, they can. They'll just be put your email in, and then it should be an automated thing where we can email it out and they can have a copy of that.
Yeah, that would be awesome. So yeah, that's awesome. I will, I'll have all of that linked in the show notes, guys, everybody that's listening. That'd be an awesome opportunity, for everybody to take advantage of. So thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and if anybody, reach out, and do my best to get back to them. Not the best responder. You may have realized that, but I do try and get to everything at some point. So,
well, hey, I am always looking for reasons to be down in Phoenix. I love Arizona. So, next time I make it down there, I'll stop by Chandler.
Yeah. Knock on my door. We'll hang out and do something for it.
Love it. All right, man. Have a great day. We'll see you.
Thank you. Soon. Yep. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks for your time. And remember, follow us on Instagram at SockDollagerWellness and hit that subscribe button. And if you have time, would you mind leaving us a rating and review? That helps us get found. As you may know, if you're an avid podcast listener, that just helps us get out there even more. So until next time, stay healthy out there.